Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website, which is www.theorganicview.com. If you have any questions or would like to connect with us, you can simply post a question on our wall on Facebook, send us a tweet to @TheOrganicView, or contact me directly at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. Today's show is sponsored by Eden Foods, one of the most trusted names in certified organic clean foods. Listeners of the Organic View Radio Show can receive 20% off any regularly priced items, excluding cases. Simply enter the coupon code ORGVIEW when prompted during checkout. That's ORGVIEW. For more special offers, please visit our website at www.theorganicview.com.
Today, my guest is Steve Lerner, and we're going to be talking about his book, Sacrifice Zones. Across the United States, thousands of people, most of them in low-income or minority communities, live next to heavy, polluting industrial sites. Many of them reach a point at which they say, enough is enough. After living for years with poisoned air and water, contaminated soil, and pollution-related health problems, they start to take action, organizing, speaking up, documenting the effects of pollution on their neighborhoods. In Sacrifice Zones, Steve Lerner tells the stories of 12 communities from Brooklyn to Pensacola that rose up to fight the industries and military bases causing disproportionately high levels of chemical pollution. He calls these low-income neighborhoods sacrifice zones. And he argues that residents of these sacrifice zones tainted with chemical pollutants need additional regulatory protections. So I would like to welcome to the show Mr. Steve Lerner. Good afternoon, Mr. Lerner, and welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, June. Thanks very much for inviting me to join you today.
Mr. Lerner, can you please share with our audience a little bit about yourself and why you chose to write Sacrifice Zones?
Certainly. I got my start as a journalist. I began after college writing for the Village Voice in New York City. In the mid-1970s, I joined with my brother, Michael Lerner, in starting a nonprofit out on the West Coast called Commonweal. That's C-O-M-M-O-N-W-E-A-L. And it means for the common good in Old English. And I started a quarterly journal on environmental threats to public health, in which I looked at the way we were basically polluting our own nest through the misuse of toxic chemicals, the overuse of them, and the criminally negligent ways in which we were disposing of them. So I got my start writing articles and publishing articles on environmental threats to public health. This led me to look at radioactive wastes and their dumping in a number of locations. And it came to my attention that there was a nuclear power plant being built south of us in San Luis Obispo that was named Diablo Canyon, Devil Canyon, and was sited on an earthquake fault. And this struck me as not a good idea, so I joined with a group of other people in the early 1980s protesting the construction of this nuclear power plant in what I felt was a vulnerable place. And I was subsequently arrested and imprisoned at the San Luis Obispo County Jail for this. And that led me to a number of years in which I wrote about prison reform. For about 5 years, I wrote about the California Youth Authority prison system and then subsequently about adult facilities around the country and how they could be reformed, how the institutional environment could be reformed. But after that, I returned to my work on chemical pollution and ended up with an interest in those populations that were most highly exposed and most vulnerable, and those were the low-income, heavily minority communities. So I ended up writing these two books. The first Diamond, The Struggle for Environmental Justice in Louisiana's Chemical Corridor, which was about a small community 25 miles west of New Orleans on the banks of the Mississippi River that was sandwiched between a Shell chemical and the Shell oil refinery. And then the second book, Sacrifice Zones, which you mentioned, where I look at a dozen case studies of people who were on the fence line with heavy industry. So briefly, that's how I got into this work, but it's all of the projects that I was involved with Commonweal had a social justice component to it, and these last two books were about environmental justice.
Thank you. As you began to do the research for the different locations, what were some of the common problems within each area that you observed?
Well, usually it starts out with a group of residents who live next to a heavy industry or a military base where large volumes of toxic chemicals are handled, disposed of, or blown up into the air through smokestacks or let out into the soil and into the groundwater. And there's usually a precipitating incident that galvanizes a kind of grassroots environmental justice organizing in one of these communities. So people are sitting around one day, and they hear that, oh my goodness, there is toxic chemicals in the groundwater. And I'll just give one example of that kind of aha moment when local residents realize they have a significant problem. In Tallevast, Florida, there were a group of residents who were living next door to a Lockheed Martin weapons plant. One day in the 1970s, they learned that the trichloroethylene, a highly toxic chemical, had migrated from the weapons plant into the groundwater. And there's a woman there, Laura Ward, who was sitting in her kitchen. Actually, this is it's September morning in 2003. When she was looking out a window, she saw a crew of hard hats drive up onto her lawn with a drilling rig and begin to drill a test well. And Laura Ward is not a shy woman. She ran down to confront the crew boss and said, you know, what the heck are you doing on my lawn? And he said, oh, we've been hired by Lockheed Martin to drill test wells around in the neighborhood to find out if pollution from their plant has gotten into the groundwater and contaminated the groundwater. And Laura Ward said that it was at that moment that she really felt the earth move beneath her feet, and she began to look at her community through a new perspective, because she and all of her neighbors were dependent on shallow wells, and they drew their water up out of this shallow aquifer into their kitchens and used it to drink, to cook with, to make baby formula, and so on. And she thought, well, if the water has the high levels of this toxic chemical in it, then we've been drinking it and bathing in it for years. And so she began to think about all of the cases of cancer and other chronic and degenerative diseases in her neighborhood and wonder whether or not the high levels of disease in her neighborhood could have been caused by this toxic exposure. So if I were to pick one thing that typifies these sacrifice zones or fence line communities, it is this experience of suddenly coming to the realization that you and your neighbors are being disproportionately exposed to high levels of toxic chemicals that cause disease and premature death. And that's the moment at which people rise up and organize.
Now, Mr. Lerner, why is it that the low-income neighborhoods are specifically targeted? Is it that the industry feels that, well, you know what, these folks don't have a lot of money, they're not going to be
yeah.
able to fight back? Is it just that reason, or are there other reasons?
Well, you know, it can be one of two reasons, really. Low-income neighborhoods are attractive for the siting of heavily polluting industries because residents in those communities tend not to be politically organized, and they don't have connections to powerful people that they could call up and say, look, we don't want this facility in our backyard. So that's one thing. The other scenario is that in areas around heavy industry, real estate prices are depressed because basically people who have a choice don't want to live next to a heavy industry because of the pollution. But because real estate values are depressed, it's cheap to move into these areas. And low-income people often really don't have the choice. They have little disposable income. And so they rent a place or buy a place that they can afford, which happens to be next to heavy industry. It is also the case that a lot of public housing is located on the fence line with heavy industry. And it's very hard to get a berth in public housing. There are long waiting lists to get into public housing. So when you finally get into a place, you're not in a good bargaining position to say, hey, I don't want to live here because it's too close to this factory or because the air is polluted or the water is polluted. Your priority is putting a roof over yourself and your family. There are various ways that you can end up on a fence line if you're a low-income resident. But I would say that a lot of these places, heavy industry moves in because they think they can get a permit and they won't face a politically organized opposition. And I'd like to take this moment to point out that there is an insidious form of zoning which is called mixed residential industrial zoning. And usually that kind of zoning only takes place in low-income communities that are not organized to go down and fight that designation. Because putting a residential community next to an industrial zone is a formula for creating environmentally induced disease and premature death that results from the residents being exposed to these high levels of pollutants coming from the factories next door.
Mr. Lerner, why aren't there buffer zones in between the residential areas and the industrial sites?
That's a wonderful question. I mean, there should be a national requirement that all heavy industries have a buffer zone around them that allows the releases to become attenuated before they reach residential zones. But there is no such law that exists. And I would suggest that the reason that it doesn't exist has to do with power politics, and that is that the heavy industries lobbyists in Congress to make sure that no such regulation is ever written. And they have deep pockets, and they can contribute to political campaigns to make sure that that doesn't happen, whereas the low-income residents in these places do not have money to make political contributions. They do not have lobbyists in Congress. So their interests are not represented in that way. And so they end up at the short end of the stick.
Thank you. There's a term that you use quite often called toxic trespass. Can you explain what that means for our audience?
Yeah, well, it's a metaphor to suggest that what is going on here in, I would judge, thousands of communities across the country that are on the fence line with heavy industry, is that these heavy industries are permitting their toxic chemicals to trespass into residential areas. And it's illegal, frankly, but the government is not doing a good job of regulating this or imposing sanctions on heavy industry when this occurs. So the typical scenario is that a large industry has a permit to release a certain amount of toxic chemicals into the air and into the water. And in theory, that permit is supposed to ensure that people are, that residents are safe and that they won't be exposed to toxic chemicals. But the fact of the matter is that those regulations are often inadequate, and that they are often exceeded when industries have industrial accidents or upsets, as they call them, and large clouds of toxic chemicals are released from their facilities. They have to report this, and sometimes they do report it, but very often it is not caught because there's no effective monitoring around their plants. Or if there is monitoring, often the people who own the monitors are the people who are, in fact, emitting the pollution. And they often ensure that those monitoring stations are not looking for the types of toxic chemicals that they're putting out, or they put the monitoring stations in the wrong place to catch the emissions. So there's a kind of a cat-and-mouse game going on, a deadly game, in which industries release these large amounts of toxic chemicals. And when they are caught by the government, they are given a slap on the wrist.
Mr. Lerner, my next question for you is, what kind of regulations are currently in place, and do you think that the industry needs to be more heavily regulated than what it currently is?
Yes. The whole regulatory issue really is a political issue. It's about power politics, and it's about the fact that low-income residents have very little political power, and the heavy industries that make large contributions to political campaigns have a lot of political power. But the fact is that for people who live next to toxic, to heavily polluting industries, they're in a dangerous situation, which is unlike the situation of many more affluent Americans who live farther away from these hot spots of pollution. So if you live right next to a heavy industry, it's unlikely that the regulations are going to really protect you adequately. So we need regulations that do protect people near these hotspots pollution, and that will require organizing and political campaigns in order to basically force Congress to pass legislation that will protect these residential populations that are in a perilous location. And to date, that has not happened. The current state of affairs is that a lot of regulations surrounding toxic chemicals are a patchwork of regulations that vary from state to state, for one thing. And even the federal regulations which apply across the country are inadequate in that they don't cover all of the toxic chemicals that industry releases. And often the amount of pollution that these companies are allowed to put out should be stricter than they currently are. So the bottom line is that people who live next to heavy industries that put out a lot of pollution are not adequately protected by our regulatory structure.
Thank you. When it comes to contamination, how can someone prove that their land has been contaminated, their water, or even the air is contaminated?
Or their own bodies. That's a great question because it cuts right to the heart of the problem here. And that is, industry depends on from a legal strategy on the fact that it is very, very difficult to prove in a court of law that the release of a toxic chemical at point A, say in a refinery or a chemical plant, caused a health effect, a disease or a premature death at point B in a residence, just across the fence line from where they're emitting the chemicals. Now, if you look at it from a common sense point of view, and you say, look, tons of this highly toxic chemical are released from this factory, and people living right next door are suffering health effects which are totally understandable and are congruent with the type of exposure that is taking place. Say a chemical causes a certain type of brain cancer, a certain type of neurological disorder, which is quite rare. And right next door in the residential community, you have a disproportionate number of these types of diseases occurring. Common sense would say that there's a cause and effect relationship here, that the release of the toxics from point A is causing a health effect right next door in point B. But when you go to a court of law, they don't accept that common sense approach. They require that you prove scientifically that the release of the chemical in one place caused the health effect in the other place. And very often industries can say, well, you know, these people have respiratory disease or they have, you know, lung cancer or whatever, and they'll say, well, maybe they smoke too much, or maybe they don't take care of their health, or maybe they have a bad diet. And they use all these excuses. They basically blame the victim. And so we need to change the way these laws are written so that it is not up to the people who are being harmed by these chemical releases to prove that they're being hurt, but rather it is up to industry to prove that it is not doing harm. In other words, shift the burden of proof. Because the situation we currently have is both is often racist and classist. It means that low-income and heavily minority populations are ending up with disproportionately high rates of environmentally induced disease and premature death. That's environmental racism. That's environmental classism. The same problems are not occurring further away from these factories among more affluent and more white populations. So we really need to change the laws and the burden of proof in order to protect these populations in sacrifice zone.
Thank you. Another question that I have for you is in regards to military bases. Why are military bases of all places targets for environmental dumping?
Well, there's a long history of the military basically feeling that it was not subject to a lot of the environmental regulations that are in force elsewhere. And their rationale basically was, what we're doing protecting the American people is too important. And sure, we deal with a lot of toxic chemicals in manufacturing weapons, in maintaining our jet fighters and our naval ships and our tanks and whatnot. And so, yes, there are releases of toxic chemicals that happen on military bases, but we have to have an exemption, basically, for this, because we need a strong military to protect people of this nation from foreign threats. So it's ironic in a way that the very force which is meant to protect us from harm is, in some cases, actually causing harm. So our military, which should be protecting us, is in fact the source of disease in populations, in some populations adjacent to the military bases. And the reason for this is that they just dispose of the toxic chemicals on site, often, in a way which is irresponsible. And in some cases, they just dig a hole in the ground and dump the toxic chemicals into the hole in the ground. And this happened at Kelly Air Force Base in Texas, one of the sites I visited. And the poisons got into the groundwater, and they seeped out under the fence line into a low-income Latin American community, and caused disease there. Because, again, people were drawing the water up into their homes, people were getting exposed. So gradually the military has been making efforts to do a better job of handling toxins. But they have a very long way to go. It's a sad fact that the U.S. military is one of the greatest polluters in the world. And we really have to get a handle on this. Our armed forces should be protecting us. They should not be causing harm.
Thank you. Since you've written the book, how many more sacrifice zones have you discovered?
Well, you know, I keep hearing about these places. I singled out a dozen case studies to look into in the Sacrifice Zones book. The geographic reach was from Florida to Alaska, from New York to California, from Texas to Ohio. And it wasn't hard coming up with places where this is happening. If you do a search, either through, newspapers and various publications, or if you look at it from some of the data that the Environmental Protection Agency collects, it's easy to find where these facilities are that emit large volumes of toxic chemicals. And then all you have to do is look at the map and see what communities are next door, and go begin to ask around about it. The ones I focused on were examples in which there had been enough pollution, there had been enough medical problems in the residential community, that grassroots environmental justice organizers had already begun a campaign, and they had you know, said enough is enough. We're gonna make sure that pollution from these plants are reduced, or that we are that the industries pay to buy out our homes and allow us to move to safer ground. So I looked at more mature environmental justice campaigns than in many other places where people are suffering silently and have yet to organize enough of a protest campaign that it's gotten into the media and kind of gotten onto the radar screen. So there are just many, many of these places. And that was the point of the book. The point of choosing 12 of these case studies was to show that there is a pattern of environmental injustice around the country, and that this is happening on our watch. You know, this is a form of environmental racism and classism that is going on today. And it's right in line with the kind of civil rights struggles which have a long history in this country. And injustice is able to change its form from generation to generation. But in this generation, one of the forms of racism is that we allow minority communities to be disproportionately poisoned by emissions from toxic facilities. And our generation really is responsible for not only pointing this out, but doing something about it. So that was the point of the book, was to shine a light on this particular kind of injustice.
Thank you. My last question for you is, how come the media hasn't covered this more thoroughly? I mean, some of the people that you wrote about, for the most part, it seems as though if you didn't take the time to write about the details of what their experiences are, nobody would ever know.
Yeah. Well, there are a variety of ways of looking at that, and one is a kind of a conspiratorial theory about the media, that the media, has become more and more corporate over the years, and is less and less likely to report on corporate malfeasance in which corporations are poisoning their neighbors. I take the view that this is a complex story. In many small newspapers around the country, you will find stories about factories that exceed their emissions standards, their permits, people complaining about toxic releases, and so on. But there's very little reporting that looks at this from a national perspective or even a state perspective and says, look, there's a pattern of these types of problems. And I can't really say why it is that we are so complacent about this. I think that people, many of us, just really don't want to know about this. It makes us very uncomfortable to know that the United States is not living up to its principles that all people should be equally protected under the law. And clearly that's not happening here. Low-income minority populations are not being equally protected against illegal exposures to toxic chemicals as are more affluent people in this country. And folks don't want to look at that. And I think that that also gets into the newsroom, onto the editorial desk, where it seems radical to suggest that, there's this pattern of injustice going on. And that's why very often when these movements occur, they come up from the bottom. They're grassroots movements. And part of what I was writing about, I was not just writing about this horrendous injustice which is going on around the country. I was also writing about the movement of grassroots activists who are organized in their neighbors to stand up and fight some of the largest transnational corporations in the world, and some of them are winning their battles. So, you know, the civil rights movement came up not because the press was doing that great a job reporting it in the beginning. It came up because of people organizing and marching and demanding their rights. And there's a similar phenomenon happening today around environmental justice. It's just that it's small compared with the civil rights movement. It's small. It's small compared with the anti-war movement, with the women's movement, and with the movement for gay and lesbian rights and so on. So what I am hopeful about is that other groups will see this injustice and join with those grassroots activists in making this issue a higher priority. Because really the environmental movement needs to adopt the environmental justice movement as the front line of the struggle against pollution in this country. After all, the people who are on the front lines are the people who are living right next door to these heavily polluting plants. So many of the Big Ten environmental groups are largely white and largely affluent members. If they join forces with these grassroots environmental justice groups, which are largely low-income and heavily minority membership, it would instantly diversify the environmental movement and make it much stronger in the process. Because the most ardent environmentalist in this country is someone who lives next to a refinery that puts out this cloud of toxic chemicals in the middle of the night, and these people have to turn off their air conditioning because air conditioning sucks air in from the outside into your home. They have to turn it off. They have to close the doors, close the windows, put towels under the doors and windows to make sure to try to keep this stuff out. And even then, the fumes get into their rooms, and they end up wetting a towel and putting it over their head to try not to choke on the pollution from the facility next door. And that makes these people angry, and it makes them activists. And it makes them some of the strongest environmental activists in the country. So I'm hoping that there will gradually grow a coalition of groups that include, you know, the environmental justice community, the environmental community, the religious community, student groups, the civil rights movement, and just a group of people who say, no, we can't permit this type of injustice to continue. We have to make this a priority. We have to push for legislation that protects this population, and we have to begin to create buffer zones, to put up monitoring stations, to do health studies in these communities, and to take a systematic approach to protecting these sacrifice zones. This is not rocket science. We can figure out how to do this if there's the political will to do it. It's obvious that the first place you look is next to facilities that are emitting large volumes of toxic chemicals. The Environmental Protection Agency has a list of those agents, of those facilities. You can plot it on a map, and then you can look at the residential communities next door, and then you can put up monitoring stations to monitor the air and water and soil and make sure that illegally high levels of toxic chemicals aren't trespassing into those communities. You can do health studies to make sure that the incidence of various diseases are not higher in those communities than elsewhere. And you can shape legislation and levy fines that are going to reduce this kind of pollution. And when necessary, you can require that industry create a buffer zone and buy people out so that they can move to a safer place. So there's a lot that could be done, but it's not going to happen unless Americans all across the country see this as an intolerable injustice and begin to organize and do something about it.
Thank you. And we actually have someone who's on hold, so I'd like to take the call.
Certainly.
Hi, do you have a call for Mr. Lerner?
Yes, my name is Hugh. I'm calling from Virginia, and I congratulate him on his work. I'm actually doing a lot of what he's saying. I'm an individual standing on my truth, and I'm working on a whole new paradigm of bringing spirituality into global economics and combining it with unconditional love, making things totally transparent, highly ethical and moral, and forcing companies to be more responsible for their employees, their customers, the environment, and the community.
Excellent. I wish there were a whole army of people like you out there.
Well, there can be if you pick up on me. I'd like to share my name. You can see some things on the Internet.
Certainly.
It's Hugh, H-U-G-H. The last name is Trawlson, T like Tom, R-A-U-L-S-E-N as in Nancy. If you put a .com after that and click on recent articles or historical articles, you'll see a front page Wall Street Journal article from back in 1983 where I exposed the former federal government bureaucrat for fraud that indirectly eventually led to the resignation of Jim Wright from Speaker of the House. And there's copies of the attachments, the original memo that I activated to cause the whole front page Wall Street Journal article.
Uh-huh.
Well, thank you very much, sir, for calling in and for sharing your information.
Yes.
It's always great when people call in to talk about what they're doing, especially in their own area, as well as to help others across the nation.
Well, thank you very much, and God bless.
Thank you. And, Mr. Lerner, I'd like to just say thank you so much for coming on the show today. It has been wonderful having you talk about the sacrifice zones. And can you please just give our audience your website and also tell them once again about your other books that you've written?
Yes. I worked for 30 years at Commonweal, and that's www.commonweal.org. And there's a description of some of our work on environmental justice issues on the Commonweal website. You can also learn more about the two environmental justice books I wrote for MIT Press at the mitpress.com website. And it describes both the book Diamond, The Struggle for Environmental Justice in Louisiana's Chemical Corridor, and the subsequent book I put out, which we've been speaking about, Sacrifice Zones, The Front Lines of Toxic Chemical Exposure in the United States.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful having you on the show today, and I would love to invite you back to talk about Diamond. I think the more information we can give to the public, the more they can empower themselves and also make the necessary changes that we need to take in order to stop this contamination of our environment.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me to join you on your show. I've very much enjoyed it, and I'd be happy to come back and talk about the Diamond book.
Thank you, Mr. Lerner. And folks, please check out Mr. Lerner's book, Sacrifice Zones, and his other book called Diamond. Thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic View Radio Show.